Thanks for having me back. So I think we've talked about Italy before, but I want to sort of bore into how democracy died in that case. I think Italy's situation is not entirely unlike Germany or Russia's, in that you start having both worker and sort of peasant uprisings, particularly in northern Italy. There's a sort of industrial triangle between Milano, Genoa, and Torino, Turin. Factories are getting taken over by workplace actions. There's a general strike in the Po Valley, also in the north. There is rural insurrection, so squatters and landless people are taking over estates. And this is all part of what's called the Biennio Rosso, the sort of red biennium, the sort of 2 years after the war where Italy was almost totally in chaos. The liberals are completely panicked. And it's in that environment of street violence, rural insurrection, factory takeovers, that the so-called squadristi, these are the fasci, these are the fascists, who are these volunteerist squads who are essentially paid, literally, the petrol they're using, the bullets they're using are paid for by factory owners or landowners. And these so-called black shirts start crushing the left, both in the countryside and in northern industrial cities. Less of this happens in the South. I mean, there's a bit of violence, but the South had pretty much always been ruled by kind of thugs working for landlords, so it's not that much of a shift. But this was new in the North. The problem for Mussolini is he's not really in charge of any of this. He's still competing with D'Annunzio, who in the middle of all this takes over a city in what's now Croatia and declares it part of Italy, which was illegal, by the way. A year later, the Italian army literally ejects him, so it's a huge fiasco. The liberal state is getting less and less legitimate, but Mussolini is the sort of figurehead looming in the background who's giving spiritual support. He's kind of a figurehead leader. And, once he does get into government, and I'll talk about that in a second, he does have patronage to offer. And I think this sort of chaotic, decentralized structure where you have sort of this combination of elites collaborating with local, what I guess you might call fascist barons, with Mussolini kind of hovering above them, has a huge effect of how fascism will look even when it does take power. So, the Red Biennium ends with the left essentially obliterated by the Squadristi. There's also people called Arditi. These were former special forces in the war who ran around stabbing Austrians with daggers who were part of this also. And a big part of what the fascists won is this idea of waging war in peacetime. I mean, essentially this idea that Caporetto had been caused by traitors and defeatists, and that had only gotten worse in the post-war era with all these left-wing insurrections. There was this notion that you needed a strong hand to crush them and also to fulfill the dream of making Italy, this imperfect thing that had not been realized, whether it was because there was territory they hadn't gotten their hands on or because, Italians didn't view themselves as Italian, the fascists were going to fix that. And it's the liberals themselves who bring Mussolini into government. Not entirely unlike what happens with the old right in Germany that we talked about. Vittorio Emanuele III, who's now king, his father had been assassinated, he assents to naming Mussolini prime minister in October. The march on Rome, there's these epic images of them marching through the rain, taking Rome. Mussolini took a train, got off with an umbrella, and waited for them to show up. So it's not a coup. I mean, there's this huge theatrical demonstration of violence and force, and the violence, of course, is implied. And without that popular support, they wouldn't have needed Mussolini, but he's handed power by the liberal establishment, who thinks he's going to be controllable. This should be sounding familiar to you by now. He can be controllable. They can use him to sort of connect popular politics and high politics. He can continue crushing the left. It's going to be fantastic. The king loses his nerve at one point and almost calls it off, but then loses his nerve again and lets him be prime minister. And so Mussolini, as of October, is now in charge of the country as the legal prime minister. And for a while, he rules not necessarily that unconventionally. I mean, the problem for the Italian fascists, even more so than in Germany, is there's all these rival power centers. So there's these industrialists who are a big part of fascism's rise in the north. There is the church, which for 40 years by this point had sat in sullen self-exile, hating the state. Literally, if you ran for politics in liberal Italy, say in 1890, you were excommunicated by the Pope. That is how hostile that relationship was. So Mussolini has to worry about them, and indeed he's the one who ultimately, quote unquote, fixes that relationship in 1929. Mussolini is the one who gives them the Vatican back as sovereign territory in the Lateran Accords. And then there's this whole tension between fascist unions which have arisen, but are their own power center. There's, people like Farinacci, who's much more radical than Mussolini, and he's juggling all of this, but essentially a bit slower than Germany, but, it's this ratchet effect. Things start getting more and more radical. Eventually, things you know, in 1924, they changed the electoral law. So the electoral law is made even more lopsided in a way that would favor the fascists. And in those general elections in 1924, the fascists won 2/3 of the seats. And I would argue that the election is not particularly legitimate, even by the standards of Italy. But in the middle of all that, you know, a guy named Giacomo Matteotti, who's a socialist journalist and big in politics, is kidnapped. This happens in June of 24 and murdered by randos. And almost immediately, people, of course, start blaming Mussolini. They're like, this has to be him. These were obviously squadristi. They were reporting to him. And at first, he really distances himself from them. But by January, he decides, no, you know what? I am going to embrace this. And there's this moment on the 3rd of January, he makes the speech to Parliament, this very infamous speech, where he says, yeah, sure, maybe I did this. What are you going to do about it? He literally just drops the gauntlet and stares at them and dares them to remove him or do anything. And they don't. And when they don't, and I'm not the only one who argues this, I think a lot of scholars would say at that moment, his power, it's still not absolute, but it becomes much stronger and more entrenched. And so throughout the rest of the 20s, you know, the fascist movement gets more and more and more powerful. It starts trying to penetrate everyday life. There's all these women's auxiliaries. There's an amazing book by DeGrazia called How Fascism Ruled Women that talks about all the ways they tried to mobilize women's energy in a way that's sort of paradoxical. We need you to stay home, but also help us build the nation. There's this thing, the OPI, which is a little bit like the Hitler Youth, that gets formed. Things radicalize a lot in 1929. The Depression just wrecks Italy, like everywhere else.
Did Hitler and Mussolini, was it like looking in a mirror when they saw each other, or was this completely an alliance of necessity and convenience? I've never really understood how those two men felt about each other.
It's complicated because at first, you know, Hitler very absolutely idolizes and looks up to Mussolini. His coup, the beer hall putsch in 23, was modeled off the March in Rome, though unlike the March in Rome, he hadn't been invited anywhere, so it's a dismal failure. When Hitler actually takes power and starts, you know, the rise of fascist Germany in 33, 34, Mussolini really resents them. He views them as Johnny-come-latelys. He's angry that other fascists are beginning to look at Germany as a model instead of Italy. So I would say up to about 35, Mussolini really doesn't take Hitler very seriously and views him as a rival and an upstart. When Germany becomes their sort of natural and kind of only ally, and that is deepened by events in Spain, which at some point maybe we could talk about, where they both go in on trying to destroy democracy there, Mussolini really comes around on Hitler. And Hitler, you know, his attitude really doesn't waver that much. He really views Mussolini as the founder of the fascist international. You know, even when other leaders in government who really don't like Italy, whether it's other party members or certainly the generals, think Italy is just a mess, Hitler won't have it. You know, there are many times when they want to, if not break the relationship with Italy, really dominate Italy, Hitler won't allow it. So that relationship, even though Germany is by far the more powerful country, certainly by the mid-30s and absolutely by the late-30s, Hitler idolized Mussolini. Mussolini, I think, had a somewhat more pragmatic attitude towards Hitler. You know, for example, in 38, when they introduced anti-Semitism, forgive me, because anti-Semitism hadn't really been a thing in Italian fascism. There were Jewish fascists in the 20s. That wasn't a contradiction. Jews in Italy were a fairly assimilated minority. They were relatively small. They, you know, lived in cities. And, you know, Italian fascism didn't really have this notion of the cities as places of darkness, because anything good that had ever happened in Italy had happened in cities. But Mussolini's shift, it's partially his growing alliance with Hitler. But the other thing is, even then, he's trying to compete with the Germans and not get out anti-Semited, which is a word I just made up, by the Germans. So there's an element of competition even when they're allies. And during the war, Italy is not a particularly great ally. They only jump in at the last minute when it looks like Germany is going to win, and even then don't perform very well. This is 1940 when they invade France. They invade Greece without permission, which is a disaster. The Germans have to bail them out of. They invade, they attack Egypt out of Libya, which again, they didn't really consult the Germans on. The Germans again have to bail them out. You know, by the midpoint of the war, Italy literally switches sides. There's a coup against Mussolini. His own fascist leaders, people like Badoglio, overthrow him. And Italy is sort of sawed in half in the north. The Germans rescue Mussolini and install him at Salo in the north. Italy enters this really brutal civil war where the fascists control sort of northern Italy along with the Germans. The free regime with the help of the Allies controls the south. And Italy just tears itself apart. I mean, literally, there are some fascist villages and some communist villages that, you know, when my advisor went to one of these places in the 70s, 30 years later, they still despised each other.
You could change names and other nouns in a lot of what you've spoken about, could seem very contemporary. What aspect, as a historian, do you look at from Mussolini and Italy and see the most similarity with events going on today?
So our contemporary authoritarian moment, and again, as I've said multiple times, I think that's a global thing, not just something that's happening here. A few things are salient to me. One is, you know, this personality cult, Mussolini's the original. You know, this idea of a personality cult that sort of covers all sins, and it's precisely how vague he was and sort of contradictory that made him all things to all people. He sort of is whatever you wanted him to be. And that personality cult, I'm not going to say it's more important than the ideology, but kind of. I think even more so in Italy than in Germany. I think National Socialism, while horrifying, it's a fairly coherent ideology. Mussolini was always an improviser and very pragmatic in a lot of ways. So this idea of a cult of personality and personality trumping ideology, I think there's an element of that that you can see in some movements today. I think this idea of volunteerism, this idea, you know, the squadristi in 1920, nobody's making them take up arms and murder leftists. I mean, they think, you know, a lot of them are vets or other people who just feel that the left is destroying the country. They want to do this. And indeed, Mussolini has to kind of scramble to get out in front of this to control it. So this sort of volunteerist activity up to and including murder, which we're seeing in places like the Pacific Northwest or, I mean, Wisconsin. I mean, that phenomenon was happening. Two more similarities. The judiciary and the police in liberal Italy were extremely soft on fascism in its lead up to taking power. One of the fears of the liberals was that if they tried to crack down on it too hard or they changed their mind about bringing them in, is that the police and the judiciary would not obey them, which I would love to tell you is not the situation now. But and then I would say a final thing that Italy really makes clear is what happens when liberal, capital or lowercase, but capital liberal democracy doesn't function. When a democratic state's legitimacy, because of perceived corruption and non-responsiveness and just being totally aloof and removed from people's concerns, that is what opens a space to either the far left, which does happen in Italy very hard in 1920, but also the far right, who first destroys leftist Italy almost completely and utterly. I mean, Gramsci literally dies in prison, and then kind of destroys liberal Italy also. Liberal Italy doesn't survive this either. Any more than the old right does in Germany. I mean, ultimately, they are, by this devil's bargain, completely undermined and rendered useless. Because after the war, it's not really the old school liberals who take charge. It's a new movement called the Christian Democrats, who, you know, that's a complicated story in and of itself, but has to do with a relationship with the church. They're very different than the old school liberals, particularly in terms of their attitude towards Christianity. You know, and they sort of pretend fascism never happened. But, I mean, Italy is a really awful warning, I think, just this whole situation I'm describing, what happens when a state ceases to be legitimate among voters and citizens. And as I said, it opens up the space for much more brutal, violent things that don't really care about democracy at all in the name of supposedly higher ideals like the nation or imperialism or, belatedly in the Italian case, the race.